This is August the 7th. I'm Dr. Reginald Carter. And Marilyn, would you say your name so the transcription?
Marilyn Fitzgerald.
Okay.
2007.
Oh, that's good to know. The way we like to start off is go back to your formative years and talk a little bit about where you were born, reared, and maybe went to school in those early days, and a little bit about your family. So could you fill us in?
Sure. Now? I was born in Danville, Illinois, and we lived there for about 7 years. My father joined the military, or reactivated after the Korean War, and so we were a military family. And we moved from Danville to Georgia, Fort Benning, Georgia, lived there for about 6 years, and then we moved to Okinawa and Japan and lived there for 4 years during junior high and high school. That was very, very important in my formative years because to this day I love Eastern culture and all things associated with that. From there, when I was a junior in high school, we moved here into the Washington area. My father was assigned to the Pentagon. And I've been here ever since. I feel that Northern Virginia is my home. And I went to college at Randolph-Macon Women's College in Lynchburg, Virginia, which just in June became a co-ed college, much to the consternation of many of the alums. That's all part of progress, I guess. I went there for my freshman and sophomore years. My junior year, I went to Scotland and studied politics and then came back to Randolph-Macon and graduated in 1968.
What was your major?
Or did I have a political science major.
What was your ambition at that time?
I wanted to be a foreign service officer.
Oh, okay.
But when I was a senior, I fell in love with somebody. And we had been out late the night before the day I was supposed to take the Foreign Service Officer exam, and I missed it. So so missing the exam meant I would have to wait another year to take it. And so I decided to get a job. My first job was with the college, Randolph-Macon. Mm-hmm. And I was an admissions recruiter, traveled to high schools and junior colleges to recruit women to come to the college. It was a little difficult at that time because it was the 60s, late 60s, 68, the beginning of the feminist movement and the sexual revolution. So women were not interested in going to women's colleges. They wanted to be out there with the men. So, but it was a fun year, and then after that year, I moved back to the Washington area and got a job with the American Association of Museums. Mm. Worked for them 6 years, helped establish their museum accreditation program, which is still in existence to this day. Museums are accredited and meet certain standards. And I decided that I wanted to sell real estate. So in 75, I left AAM and started selling real estate. And that was not the best time to sell real estate because interest rates were 18% to 21%, and it was difficult for people to qualify to buy homes. But I loved it, and did that for 2 years. And we decided to move to Crystal City. And from we lived in McLean and decided to move to Crystal City. So I went to an employment agency and said, I want a job in Crystal City. So they sent me to the offices of AAPA and the Association of PA Programs, and I loved the concept. You know, it was a brand new profession at that time, 1977, and met with Don Fisher, the first executive director of AAPA, and was really psyched, and he offered me a job at AAPA, which I've been here ever since.
So how far did you have to travel?
I walked. Mm-hmm. It was about a half a mile. It was great. And they have, Crystal City has underground walkways, so I could, I was always the one on snow days. I had no excuse. You know, I could always be in the office. So I walked to work, and
So who interviewed you for the job? Was it Don and a couple other
Don
people?
Don Fisher. I think Don was probably the only one who interviewed me, because there weren't many people, many staff members. Oh, I probably met with Marty Wilson, who was Don Fisher's director of administration at that time.
What was a job title that you applied for?
My first job was executive assistant to the executive director, Don Fisher. And because there were only about 10 staff members, that included a lot of responsibilities. But my main ones related to assisting him with his projects. And then I handled many of the same things that I handle today. The House of Delegates, the Board of Directors, we had a few committees back then, the constituent organizations. And I did that for about 8 or 9 months. And then we were starting to expand, and I became the Director of Public Education and Administrative Services. And in that role, I helped develop the public education program at that time, developed fact sheets, informational brochures, public service announcements, publications. The first edition of AAPA News was during that time, and that time also we were working on our relationships with a journal. It was first it was Physician Assistant Journal, then it was Health Practitioner, and then Physician Assistant Magazine, and so I'm sure you've heard know about all that, but and then in addition to the publications and public education, I handled administrative services. We had, you know, it was a 70s office that had no computers. We had electric typewriters. We had a photocopier that produced 10 copies a minute and didn't collate. And I remember when we got our first microwave for the kitchen, which was like a scandal that we had spent $300 on a microwave for the staff to be able to cook their lunch.
And you were serving both the academy and the association, taking
pretty
care
much,
of both boards
right,
and all those things at that time.
Right, because APAP had established that office. They had gotten the grants from Robert Wood Johnson and the other foundations, and they also had a large federal grant, research grant.
Right.
So that the money from those APAP programs were actually funding the space.
Do you recall what the membership in the academy was when you first came in 77?
Was about 3,000 or so. Yeah, it was low, and you know the records were kept on typewritten lists. And I remember when they first started recording the members on punch cards, and we'd send them out to a service bureau, and then they'd send us back a big old printout, you know, on the green lined paper of our members.
What was the conferences like? What was the first conference you went to? You remember?
First one I went to was Las Vegas, and that was in 1978. And the House of Delegates had just begun the previous year, and the House of Delegates was part of my responsibility. So, and we had no structure at all. I remember passing out typewritten resolutions that people composed, you know, in their rooms on individual chairs. It was total chaos. But somehow we managed to, you know, adopt mm-hmm. some policies and create programs. But Las Vegas, yeah, we had it in Caesar's Palace with these velvet curtains in the background. It was a small conference, you know, there weren't mm-hmm. that many people. And then each year the conferences got bigger and more structured.
Who were the PA leaders at that time? Do you recall president and the Speaker of the House?
Mm-hmm. Dan Fox was mm-hmm. the new incoming president. He was a wonderful president. I was looking at his report to the House this morning to remind me of all. He was so ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you read the resolutions that he was proposing, he had many on quality assurance, preventive health, policies on nurse practitioners, state regulatory acts, specialization, VAs as house officers. Very interesting. You know how the pendulum swings?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Dan Fox stood out. The Speaker of the House was Bill Hughes,
mm-hmm.
who left the next year, and then Elaine Grant assumed the Speaker role. Mm-hmm. You know, Elaine Grant, Marian Ramos, Ron Rosenberg were the early House officers. Scott Chavez.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In thinking back and seeing how things have evolved, of course, the House has gotten better about
mm-hmm.
how they conduct business. But what's the greatest changes that you've kind of seen from those early days that evolved as far as the Academy, per se?
Mm-hmm.
Any sense of...
I think the main theme was just structure.
Mm-hmm.
The National Office developed systems and structures for things. For example, the House of Delegates, as you mentioned. You know, we created, and Scott Chavez was very instrumental in this, we created standards for the meeting materials,
mm-hmm.
for how a resolution would appear, how the seating would be, how reports were created, how hearings were conducted. I mean, just lots of detail that make the production better, more productive. And then within the national office, the creation of different departments that specialized in different projects,
mm-hmm.
rather than one person being jack of all trades, we did specialize. Now that also, over the years, to me, has been sort of a drawback because
mm-hmm.
You have communication problems. Everyone
mm-hmm.
doesn't know what everyone else is doing because we're so specialized. Same things that happen in medicine.
Right.
The losing the human touch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we had fewer members, it was so easy to have personal relationships
mm-hmm.
with
mm-hmm.
more members, but. Now the it's just not that way.
There were constituent chapters and they were forming, but there weren't as many specialty PA
Correct.
Organizations.
There really were not. There mm-hmm. weren't even when I started. Weren't even constituent chapters in all the states.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the big achievements I think in those early years. Jim Canepa, Dan Fox were instrumental in that. Chartering chapters. Establishing the guidelines and structure for how they would report to AAPA.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the early bylaws in those days, they're so interesting how much they have changed
mm-hmm.
related to all of the structures and reporting mechanisms. But you're right, as far as specialty organizations and caucuses, none of those existed at that time, except maybe the surgical
Mm-hmm.
PAs, but they weren't an association at that time. They were the Surgical Congress and sort of an informal group.
Mm-hmm. When you came on board, accreditation was being handled by Mac Detmer and the AMA
Correct.
At that time.
Mm-hmm. Correct, right.
And so that's been, another major change.
Yes, it has, right, and change of names of the organization that handled it, and just that now that it is an independent organization, accreditation review commission.
And a national commission.
National commission, yeah, that had just been, I think a couple years before I came, had just been established, and they were, you know, developing all of their systems. I think from the beginning, though, there always seemed to be controversy surrounding that because of, you know, anybody, I don't think I could stand to be tested as often as PAs are. I mean, it was a really difficult
issue. Yeah, it's a bittersweet kind of thing. PAs have more flexibility because of the way they tested, but at the same time, for those who specialize, it it really causes a lot of anxiety.
Yes.
That has been felt in academy, I think, for years and
years.
Yes,
it has.
Yeah.
Looking
at the PA profession now, standing outside the organization, the academy itself, and watching it develop, how much did you know about PAs? Did you read anything before you took the job, or did you just, the name implied what it was? Or?
Well, when I saw the name on the front door before, as I came for my interview, I thought, because, you know, back then we didn't have Google, and, you know, and they didn't have many brochures, I thought PAs were anybody who helped in a doctor's office, a physician assistant, you know, the receptionist, the medical assistant. So, I was not aware of what a PA was.
What's been the biggest change as far as the profession goes? In other words, what the expectations of a PA were when you came on board and what it is today? How has that evolved? And how, what do you think of the major?
I think the PAs, when I came, PAs were still in the pioneer years. You know, they were still having lots of problems with regulations, legislation. You know, not all the states had legislation. And the legislation they had often was very restrictive. So the growth in those programs really has helped. What was your question?
Looking at the profession itself and how the role has changed, how have you seen the role change?
Yes, definitely seen the role change. I think PAs have, well, I know there's more acceptance, patient acceptance by other health professionals. I think they've gained a bit more autonomy in the role that they can play. I think that there is a lot more independence, however, that PAs will eventually obtain. I think that is the future. It's hard to talk about. People hate to mention independence, but I think that that's going to be the next change. I think there'll be a lot of people within the PA profession who fight it because of the fear that organized medicine will object and that we'll lose our alliances there. But it doesn't seem to have hurt nurse practitioners. And we often hear PA saying that employers tell them they would rather hire a nurse practitioner because they don't have to be so closely supervised.
That's changed a lot. The supervision used to be countersign things within 24 hours, and now it's pretty well done away with that.
Yes,
but
that
autonomy, level of autonomy and supervision still something the profession is dealing with. Looking at your own role in the academy, how has your position changed over the years? You started out more as administrative assistant to the executive director and taking care of board and those kinds of things. Have you become more specialized as years yourself?
Yes. As the years progressed, more specialized. I did the public education, then publications, and then in 82 I did primarily membership promotion, retention, services, programs, and the development of constituent organizations. I did that the longest for the time that I've been at the Academy, probably, well, I guess started in 82 and stopped doing it full time in about 96. So many, many years did that, and membership grew. I think when I started in 82, we had about 8,000 members, and when I stopped doing it in 96, we had three times that many, 24,000. So that was very specialized. In 93, when Steve Crane came, he asked me to help him with the reorganization of the staff and the structures of the office, which we did. And at that time, I became the senior vice president, still handling membership, but also overseeing several other departments within the organization. And
so this was the beginning of having vice presidents take certain chunks and being responsible for.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, we created departments, and within the departments, divisions.
Tara down 405. Tara 405.
I think we can, next time that comes up, actually we can probably unplug it. Because we're not expecting the call.
No.
That way we won't be interrupted.
Okay.
We're back.
Okay.
Yes, we created departments, and within the departments, divisions. So, Department of Government and Professional Affairs, Communications and Information Services, Research, Data Systems, Finance. And then my department, governance and leadership development.
You started out in Crystal City, and then there was a big move.
Right. In Crystal City, we were there until 83. And in 83, we moved to Roslyn, Arlington. We also had changes of executive directors at that time. In Crystal City, we had Don Fisher and Peter Rosenstein. In Roslyn, in 83, when we moved there, we had Peter Rosenstein, who soon left, and Lynn May came on. And we stayed in Roslyn until 88. In 1988, we finished building this building and moved over. I think we had about 30 staff members when we moved here. And then Steve Crane was hired in 93. In 97, we decided to expand the building. The land next door became available, and we decided to expand the building because the staff was growing, and finished it in 98, and now have a little bit over 80 staff members. And now with Steve Crane leaving, we'll have a new era.
Right. In looking at the roles that you've played, is there any one or two things that stand out in your mind as really challenging in the sense that you went home maybe at night thinking, how are we going to solve this problem, or how are we going to deal with this? Are there a couple things that stick in your mind?
I guess the biggest problems related to, because I worked so closely with boards of directors, the major problems that were the biggest challenges related to interactions between the board of directors and the executive directors or the executive vice president. So politics.
Yeah.
Those were the biggest challenges. They were never so difficult, though, that I lost sleep over them. Mm-hmm. But I guess the most traumatic time was in the early years, this is 78, 79, mm-hmm. when we almost ran out of money.
Yes, I remember.
We almost, Don Fisher had to get a second mortgage on his home to keep things running. And I remember having all-night board meetings where we were trying to decide how we were going to survive. Mm-hmm. And it involved, the final solution was to raise the dues.
Right.
Which helped bring in more money. Mm-hmm. That was probably the biggest challenge. The others, politics, we were able to overcome them because in professional societies you have leaders who move on. You know, you have the elections process and leaders mm-hmm. who move on. So you have new personalities every year.
I think that's probably in every organization mm-hmm. that you're going to have those tensions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
In looking at the same period of time, what are some things you're the proudest of in your role? Again, mm-hmm. the things that you were able to achieve or feel like you had a hand in achieving mm-hmm. for the Academy?
I think having been here as long as I have, 30 years, I have a great sense of pride in the structure of the organization, how we are organized mm-hmm. and responsive to our membership. So I would say the systems and the structure and the way things sort of click. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the strengths of the organization because we have so many staff members who have been here. You know, we have the continuity. Mm-hmm. We're not always recreating the wheel like a lot of organizations do when they lose staff. On the other hand, it's good to have change occasionally. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we wish some people would move on so that we could, you know, mm-hmm. institute change because we do get set in our ways. Mm-hmm. But I would say building this building, mm-hmm. Expanding the building was a major achievement. I'm very proud of that. It was involved lots of detail. Mm-hmm. And you know, even moving into it, keeping people, making people happy that they liked their new space and all the things that go into building something. Mm-hmm. Working with the architect and, you know, even the sign on the building downstairs and the carpeting, choice of carpeting and things like that. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of how we have involved as many volunteers as want to be involved. I think we have a lot of leadership opportunities for PAs who wish to be involved, and we're very generous to our volunteers. We, you know, pay their way to meetings, and many associations do not do that.
Right.
So I would say the structure, the organizational systems we've developed, the actual building itself, and then providing opportunities for members to take a leadership role in the organization are the things I'm most proud of.
Looking at the crystal ball just a little bit, what do you think is the greatest challenge ahead for PAs? You mentioned a few things mm-hmm. like independency mm-hmm. and issues, but what other challenges out there do you see?
I think the other one is finding a role that is unique in the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I think PAs could do more to provide that advocate role for mm-hmm. the patient. Since we hear so many horror stories of how patients get lost in the system, you know, they go to mm-hmm. one specialist and another, and they're conflicting information. I think PAs could serve a very important role there. Again, I do think independence is something that will eventually come. And just continuing to be vigilant. I mean, we have issues every day. We hear of issues of PAs being thwarted in what they are legally permitted to do. I mean, there's a situation right now with the truck clinics at truck stops, a new venture that John McGallagher, who was a former board member, and some PAs are involved with in Arkansas. We just got a call last week that Arkansas has closed down one of the clinics because PAs aren't supposed to. There's too much independence, not being supervised enough. So just that constant vigilance and making sure that we're included in legislation and regulations, and that we're not being, PAs are not being unfairly treated.
Yeah, unlike medicine, I guess we still have a lot of variety as far as states go, and it's hard to develop clinics across a nation and think that you can handle each one the same. Is difficult, so
yes.
I understand what you're talking about. Again, you talked about finding niches for PAs or those areas, and the PAs themselves now are pushing more towards making an impact in preventive health care. That's been a major topic. It's tough because the systems that pay for preventive health are not there. So do you see PAs taking more leadership roles in policy decision making and those
definitely
things?
Yeah, I think that PAs, and that's part of our leadership development program, to encourage people to take those leadership roles. We've sort of focused on leadership within constituent organizations and in your community, but there's so many leadership roles that PAs could assume in helping change the way medicine is handled. In preventive medicine, PAs are perfect in that role, along with the patient advocacy.
Don't want to put you on the spot, but when you think about the people that you've worked with on staff, executive directors, other folks, are there any particular individuals that stand out and or just the environment of working for the Academy over the years? Can you just give us a little insight and feel about the people and maybe the environment?
I think the early years are probably the early years of PAs and fellow staff members are the ones I remember the most and feel that had the most clout. I think Don Fisher was a wonderful executive director. I think, you know, he established the national office. He was a great public speaker, really got things off the ground. I think that Steve Crane has, on the opposite end of, you know, 30 years later, has done the same thing. He's been a really strong advocate for the profession and has really helped the profession progress. The early leaders, I mentioned Dan Fox, Tom Godkins, Bill Stanhope, sort of the fathers that we think of, who really helped establish and, you know, kept after it, could have given up so easily if it didn't. Charlie Huntington, Scott Chavez, Judy Willis.
Oh, yeah.
Many of these people no longer are in, you know, working as PAs, but I think that's okay because they love the profession and they promote it in their own settings. In years since those early years, I think Libby Coit was a great president, really helped with the legislative efforts. Paul Lombardo, Bill Kohlhepp, many you know, many of them are still very active in practicing. As far as within fellow vice presidents, I think that Nicole Guerra, and Bob Johnston has really helped with the financial security of the organization, as has Bruce, treasurer of AAPA. And the others who've plugged away in the trenches, Shelley. Shelley Hicks, and I think Cheryl Kasunich is a new staff member, new 5 years, has really done a lot to help us modernize a lot of our systems.
Looking at diversity within the profession, that's been a major change. When you came in, I guess it was still mostly male. Females were just developing leadership roles in the academy, except for folks like Joyce Nichols and Clara Vanderbilt and Judy Willis and some of those that we mentioned before. But how do you feel about that, the diversity? You feel like the academy has done a good job in recognizing diversity and
I think we've done more recently. I think the Committee on Diversity that we have established now is going to accomplish lots of good things. We really haven't had we haven't, because of the PA program enrollment and, you know, more women choosing it, or more women applying, or more women being accepted, we really haven't had any, we haven't been able to influence that at all. It's just, it's happened. But as far as encouraging the others of ethnic origin, I think we still have a lot more to do there. I don't know how we're going to do it, but the Committee on Diversity is addressing that issue. Diversity has definitely changed things, though, as far as the gender, with more women in the PA graduating from PA programs. I think that, I mean, we've even seen it in our elections. The past three elections, women have been the presidents.
We now have two additions to the supporting organizations of the Academy. One's the OERF, Educational Research Foundation, that's now the Physician Assistant Foundation. And the newest member, of course, is the Society for PA History. Do you have any thoughts about the foundation? I remember you were there when I was, when the ERF got started.
Yeah.
And it had a very limited-looking role. I mean, research was a major part of it, and scholarships, as I recall, that was the kind of the two things. And it sputtered a little bit, I think, in the beginning. But what's your thoughts about the foundation and how that's grown over the years?
I think the foundation recently, the programs, the community-based programs, and the PA practice-related programs have been are great. I think that they, I'd like to see more expansion. I think the scholarship program, you know, the legacy that the ERF left is strong. The foundation is a really important arm of AAPA. I think, I hope that they can maybe raise more funds private foundations or others to increase the programs that they are able to provide. But they're continuing to be an important arm of us.
As far as, of course, I'm biased about the PA History Group, but as I recall, when we first met, you were there at the table representing the Academy.
Yeah.
And that's gosh, it's been 7 years ago. It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts when we first had that meeting, the advisory group, to talk about the PA History Office and trying to come up with some formal mechanism for preserving our history?
I thought that it was a wonderful, wonderful plan. And I'm especially happy now that we have taken more of a role in support and having Kevin help lead its future. It was interesting, you know. I mean, it's a short history, and you know, when we think of history, we think of hundreds of years. But it's so important to get it started while everyone still remembers things. While we're still kicking. I think it's great, the oral history project that you've done.
Wow. Well,
I would love to see some of those.
Well, I want to get this on the record. You were one of the first to write a check,
I
recall, for $100 at the leadership conference. And so not only did you attend the advisory meeting, but you financially was one of the first contributors as well. So.
And I took a picture of it.
You sure did.
I set up, or we had, I don't know whether we put it on a TV, put the camera on the TV or what, but...
We may be the only organization that has a picture of the first.
Yeah, that's meeting. True. Absolutely.
Because I would ask people, and so they said, "Well, we didn't know we were making history,
that's
so
interesting.
we didn't take any pictures." As we end the interview today, I know there must be other thoughts and other things that you have that we haven't touched on. Are there other things you would like to add to the rector after seeing all this evolve over 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
Any recollections that just come to mind when you think about those 30 years?
Well, I think it's been just so exciting to be part of a profession that is young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look back in 1973, 1974, when they established the national office, to be able to know where each one of the offices was as the organization grew, knowing many of the past presidents, working with past presidents from 30 years, and seeing how involved so many of those people still are. I think, you know, it's a family. It really is a tight-knit, bonded group. My stories are probably, you know, I think we've sort of grown old together, even though we're still not that old, but, you know, we've gone through various stages of life together. I remember, you know, before many of these people were married, married, and now I see that they have children who are getting married. So, I think that we're very fortunate to have a profession that's still small enough that we can know each other and keep in touch.
I think that collective struggle in those early years for that group really seals them together. And the veterans certainly are a close-knit group, the military PAs.
Yes.
There's a family, and then within the family there's certain ties there too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's been interesting to see all that develop over
time.
So I know where you're coming from on that. It's amazing to look at a profession where, 90% of the people are highly satisfied.
I know. Isn't that a wonderful tribute to the profession? And I think that will continue. I think there are struggles ahead because, you know, there are major things that need to be changed to make healthcare better in America. And it will be interesting, too, to see how the profession see if there's expansion of the profession internationally. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is to a certain extent. It seems to have sort of, there was a big sort of spurt, and then it's sort of quieted down. I don't know what's going on, but I think that it'll be fun to watch that too. Maybe someday there will be an international association or academy of PAs in our lifetime.
Right. Anything else you'd like to add to the record before we end?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it, and thank you for everything you've done to make the History Society a reality.
Well, I thank you for that, but also for the record, I want to thank you for the 30 plus years that you've been involved too,
thank you.
The staff of the Academy.
It's hard to believe it's been that long, isn't it?
Yeah.